Welcome. You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Hello and welcome to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. Thank you for joining us. This is the Black Experience Hour. My name is Susan, and the following recording is intended solely for the use of blind, visually impaired, and print format disabled individuals. And it's being recorded on the 3rd of April for the listening week that began the 3rd. And I apologize, I'm a day late this week. I hope this transfers successfully into so that it can be heard during this week. Pardon me. Anyway, let's start with an article from the political world. We're reading from theroot.com at present. And this was written by Terrell Germain Starr, posted on the 2nd. Biden's $2 trillion infrastructure plan aims to empower people of color. President Joe Biden unveiled a $2 trillion infrastructure program in Pittsburgh on Thursday that aims to address urban planning that displaced black people from their communities and other economic disparities, according to the New York Times. The nuts and bolts of the plan are to repair dilapidated roads, bridges, rail lines, and other aspects of the economy with the mindset to reframe how the government builds communities. Basically, Biden is saying that the way we built communities back in the day was really racist, and to make up for that, we're pouring billions of dollars into people of color neighborhoods. One example used to illustrate how infrastructure was built with racist intentions is that of an elevated freeway that was built through the center of Claiborne Avenue in New Orleans in the late 1960s. It ended dozens of black-owned businesses and raised tree-lined streets full of black folks who tried in vain to stop the project. More than 60 years later, Biden's plan is working to reverse this by replacing lead pipes in cities that have suffered through water poisoning and the cleanup of environmental hazards in Latinx communities and tribal communities. It would also fund worker training programs for underserved communities and money for home care workers who are usually women of color and highly underpaid. That is in the first phase of the plan. The second phase will address racial opportunity gaps in universal pre-K and affordable higher education. Since this is a new initiative, the details are likely to change as it makes the round through Congress. The plan calls for raising corporate taxes, something Republicans have expressed concerns about, but liberal economists praise the plan. According to the Times, this is a promising start, said Trevon Logan, an economist at Ohio State University, whose work includes studies of how government spending projects, like the one that built the interstate highway system, have excluded or hurt Americans who are not white. The biggest single piece of the plan's racial equity efforts is not a transportation or environmental project, but a $400 billion investment in in-home care for older and disabled Americans. It would lift the wages of care workers, who are predominantly low-paid female and not white. Another supporter of the plan agrees, it's the first jobs program that is focused primarily on work done by women of color, said Mary Kay Henry, the president of the Service Employees International Union. It's going to transform black, brown, and Asian lives and entire communities. Compared to its European and Asian counterparts, America's infrastructure is in horrible shape, while countries like France, England, China, and Japan provide access to bullet trains. Americans are stuck with Amtrak railways that break down like hoop ties. Our airports lag behind those in other developed nations, and our overdependence on cars and a lack of public transportation are causing health issues in the U.S. If this bill is to see the light of day, Biden will have to act fast. Democrats have slim majorities in Congress, and midterms are next year. If they do not play their cards right and fast, Democrats could lose both chambers, and this very promising infrastructure bill won't be signed into law. Next article was posted on the 2nd, written by Ishina Robinson. Georgia faith leaders call for April 7th boycott if companies don't step up a fight against voter restriction laws. Stacey Abrams says, hold off. Georgia Republicans' recent passage of voter suppression measures is facing a building challenge from stakeholders in the state, and corporations continue to be called on to play a larger role in the fight for voting rights. On Thursday, faith leaders from Georgia, including African Methodist Episcopal Bishop Reginald T. Jackson, announced their push for a boycott of many of the state's most well-known businesses on April 7th, unless the company's leaders go even further in opposing the new voting measures signed into law by Governor Brian Kemp last week. The legislation requires photo ID for people seeking to vote by mail, allows the state election board to take over programs from local election officials, and even prohibits people from handing out food and water to voters waiting in line. On Wednesday, the CEOs of Delta Airlines and Coca-Cola issued forceful statements calling the law unacceptable, but the statements notably came days after the bill's signing. Speaking at a press conference held in the world of Coca-Cola in Atlanta, a day later, Jackson and others called on the corporations to put some more skin in the game. The next quote is from WSB-TV Atlanta. The group is calling on corporate heads to meet in the coming days and agree to a press conference where they'd publicly condemn the law, publicly denounce similar measures in other states, support the current federal lawsuits against Georgia, and express support for federal voting rights legislation. Those corporations would include Aflac, Delta, Coca-Cola, Home Depot, and more of the state's largest employers. If they commit and if they act, we won't boycott, said one of the lawsuit's plaintiffs. Bishop Reginald Jackson, let me say it again, commit and act. Faith without works is dead. Speaking with Politico, Jackson said the boycott is necessary to push the companies to stand up for black voters in Georgia, including through financially supporting lawsuits that have been filed against the new laws. I really don't want to boycott Delta, but if Delta can't support me, there is no need for me to continue to support Delta, he said. When we hold back our money from these corporations, it forces them to act. The black community puts a ton of money in support of these corporations. Meanwhile, Fair Fight Action's Stacey Abrams, who has been a leader in the fight to expand voting access in Georgia, is asking people not to boycott companies in the state due to the repercussions the actions would have on the workers. Abrams said in a video statement on Wednesday, "To our friends across the country, please do not boycott us. Boycotts have been an important tool throughout our history to achieve social change. But here's the thing. Black, Latino, AAPI, and Native American voters, whose votes are the most suppressed under HB 202, are also the most likely to be hurt by potential boycotts of Georgia." Abrams instead called on companies in Georgia and around the country to come off the fence in condemning the spread of voter suppression bills in several states, and to support federal legislation, namely the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, or the For the People Act, that would protect voting rights. Companies seem to be getting a little quicker on the uptake in light of what has been unfolding in Georgia. According to the Texas Tribune, just after the Texas legislature advanced its own restrictive voting laws on Thursday, American Airlines and Dell publicly opposed the proposals on the basis that they would limit voting access. The two companies have their headquarters in the Lone Star State. Moving to that article to hear a little bit more about the Texas actions, now reading from the Texas Tribune, which was written by Alexa Ura, posted April 1st. Corporate giants come out against Republicans' efforts to restrict voting in Texas. Multiple major corporations based in Texas spoke out Thursday in opposition to Republicans' legislative proposals to further restrict voting in Texas. Corporate giants American Airlines, based in Fort Worth, and Dell Technologies, headquartered in Round Rock, are among the first to take a position. American Airlines took specific aim at Senate Bill 7, which would impose sweeping restrictions that take particular aim at local efforts meant to make it easier to vote, like extended early voting hours. Senate Republicans advanced that measure in a 2 a.m. vote Thursday. Early this morning, the Texas State Senate passed legislation with provisions that limit voting access. To make Americans' stance clear, said the company in a statement, we are strongly opposed to this bill and others like it. Dell Technologies CEO Michael Dell declared his company's opposition to House Bill 6, another voting proposal, in a Twitter post, that legislation would prohibit local election officials from proactively sending out applications for mail-in ballots and impose new rules for people assisting voters to fill out their ballots. The House Elections Committee on Thursday was hearing public testimony on the proposal that was expected to continue into the night. Dell said, free, fair, equitable access to voting is the foundation of American democracy. Those rights, especially for women, communities of color, have been hard earned. Governments should ensure citizens have their voices heard. HB 6 does the opposite, and we are opposed to it. Both measures are legislative priorities for Texas Republicans who this year are mounting a broad campaign to scale up the state's already restricting voting rules, and pull back on local voting initiatives championed in diverse urban centers, namely Harris County, during a high turnout election in which Democrats continued to drive up their margins. That push echoes national legislative efforts by Republicans to change voting rules after voters of color helped flip key states to Democratic control. Also on Thursday, AT&T and Southwest Airlines, both based in Dallas, issued statements that didn't mention any specific legislation, but expressed broad support for voting rights. The statement from Southwest Airlines said, the right to vote is foundational to our democracy and a right coveted by all. We believe every voter should have a fair opportunity to let their voice be heard. AT&T's statement said it would be working with the Business Roundtable, quote, to support efforts to enhance every person's ability to vote. We understand that election laws are complicated, not our company's expertise, and ultimately the responsibility of elected officials, but as a company, we have a responsibility to engage. The statements come just a day after black business leaders called on corporations to publicly oppose Republican proposed restrictions across the country, a response to new restrictions in Georgia that were recently passed into law with little opposition from major companies. In response to American Airlines opposition, Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick of Texas, who deemed SB 7 a legislative priority, released a statement in which he argued the legislation included, quote, comprehensive reforms that will ensure voting in Texas is consistent statewide and secure. Texans are fed up with corporations that don't share our values trying to dictate public policy, said Patrick. But the legislation has been met by fierce opposition from Democrats and a collection of civil rights organizations that have warned its restrictions and its focus on local initiatives pushed in Harris County could lead to intimidation and disenfranchisement of voters of color and voters with disabilities. That coalition now includes representatives of corporate America. The American Airlines statement read, any legislation dealing with how elections are conducted must ensure ballot integrity and security while making it easier to vote, not harder. As the House Elections Committee heard public testimony on the bill late Thursday, Microsoft also raised concerns with HB 6's prohibition on sending vote-by-mail applications to voters who haven't requested, an initiative taken up by several Texas counties as voters sought to avoid the dangers of in-person voting during a pandemic. Some counties sent applications to voters 65 and older who automatically qualified to vote by mail in Texas, while Harris County's attempted to send applications to all 2.4 million registered voters in the county with specific instructions on how to determine if they were eligible. That effort was ultimately blocked by the state courts teeing up Republicans' legislative proposals to prevent a repeated attempt through both HB 6 and SB 7. Microsoft is headquartered near Seattle in a county and state where our elections are conducted entirely by mail, and where our firsthand experience leads us to believe that voting by mail can make voting more convenient and more secure, read the tech giant's statement, which went on, for that reason, we would encourage you to explore ways to make the secure use of absentee ballots more accessible for all Texas voters. It remains to be seen if the corporate opposition to Republicans' proposals will match the barrage of outcry during the Texas legislature's 2017 debate over a so-called bathroom bill to restrict transgender Texans' access to public facilities. That year, transgender women, men, and children from across Texas descended on the Capitol to testify about how that proposal would endanger their lives. They were joined by a broad faction of businesses in rallying opposition to the legislation, which did fail to pass. Major Texas employers are stepping up and speaking out against voter suppression, and for good reason. Texans should not go down the same path as Georgia. This was from former House Speaker Joe Strauss, the San Antonio Republican who helped bottle up the bathroom bill in the House. It's bad for business, and more importantly, it's bad for our citizens. Texas voting rights groups, including Texas Organizing Project, Move Texas, and the Texas Civil Rights Project, have joined with Black Voters Matter to demand similar stands on by corporations against Republicans' bills, starting with full-page ads in the local newspapers in recent days. Moving on to other news now. This comes back from backtotheroot.com for this. Virginia Supreme Court rules that Charlottesville can remove a pair of Confederate statues. This is written by Joe Girardo, posted on Thursday. That would be Thursday the 1st. Considering the level of violence and chaos white supremacists brought to Charlottesville, Virginia nearly 4 years ago, it's not terribly surprising that that city isn't exactly gung-ho about preserving its Confederate monuments. The city can now remove two statues of Confederate generals Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson after the Virginia Supreme Court overturned a prior decision forbidding that. The Associated Press reports that while the city council voted to remove the statues in 2017, A group of Charlottesville residents sued to prevent that from happening. A circuit court judge initially ruled in favor of the residents, citing a law that regulated, quote, the disturbance of or interference with monuments and memorials dedicated to soldiers. As previously mentioned, Charlottesville was pretty much the harbinger of what unfortunately has become a pretty commonplace occurrence in the wake of the former president's election. A group of white boys all hopped up on conspiracy theories and false aggrievements, acting out in ways that have violent, and in this case, deadly consequences. The 2017 Unite the Right rally saw white supremacists and counter-protesters violently clash. The event came to an horrific head after a man drove his car through a group of counter-protesters, killing one, Heather Heyer, in the process. So the fact that after all that happened, and some Charlottesville residents still were against removing the statues, only goes to show just how deeply white supremacy is embedded into this country's fabric. Truly, it's the American way. The statue of Jackson was erected in Jackson Park in 1921, and the statue of Lee was erected in Lee Park in 1924. State Supreme Court Justice Bernard Goodwin reversed the circuit court decision on Thursday, saying that because the statues weren't protected under the law as they were erected before the law was written. In other words, the law did not provide the authority for the city to erect the statues, and it does not prohibit the city from disturbing or interfering with them, wrote Goodwin. Next one, written by Terrell Germain Starr, posted Thursday. Long-term solitary confinement to end in New York State. After years of activism and political power shifts, New York State will end long-term solitary confinement in prisons and jails. The New York Times reports that Governor Andrew Cuomo signed into law a bill that will restrict the use of this abusive practice up to 15 consecutive days. The law also bars the use of solitary confinement for people with physical and mental disabilities, pregnant women, minors, and other groups of people. While this is a major step forward, the bill will not go into effect until next March. One of the provisions in the law will focus on the mental health of people being placed in solitary confinement. Prisons and jails will be mandated to screen for suicide risk and create new rehabilitation units for prisoners who need to be separated from the general population for more than 15 days. Black and Latinx people make up roughly 70% of people in New York State prisons and represent more than four-fifths of those in solitary confinement. Across the country, state lawmakers are pushed to end solitary confinement. Research has consistently shown that this practice increases risk for self-harm and suicide, death rates after release, and worsened mental illness. Here is more background on how New York State made progress on restricting the practice, according to the New York Times. A large campaign to limit the use of solitary confinement in New York kicked off more than 8 years ago, but those efforts had long fallen short in Albany. The state agreed in 2015, following a lawsuit, to changes that included improved living conditions in isolation. A measure similar to the new law appeared primed to pass in 2019, but ultimately died after union pushback and a threat of veto from Mr. Cuomo, who cited concerns over large potential costs to carry out the changes. Parentheses, those projections were later disputed. Instead, the governor agreed to roll out several less expansive administrative changes to alter the practice. After Democrats secured a legislative supermajority in last November's elections, which allowed a veto from the governor to be overridden, their efforts to pass the measure gained traction. Activists in recent weeks staged several rallies outside Mr. Cuomo's office in Manhattan, The measure passed both chambers with wide support this month, and some lawmakers threatened to push ahead even without Mr. Cuomo's signature. It remained unclear on Wednesday night which aspects of the legislation, if any, may face changes. End of quote. Of course, unions for correctional officers are pushing back against the law, saying that it puts their officers at risk. There is no real research that says using solitary confinement actually changes behavior for the better. In fact, research shows the opposite is true. The most well-known case of solitary confinement was the story of Kalief Browder. He took his own life after being released from Rikers Island, after spending years in jail for a crime he never committed, and awaiting a trial that never happened. It would be ideal for New York State to end the practice altogether, but these restrictions are a step forward to solitary confinement being abolished eventually. Our next one, also posted on Thursday, the 1st, written by Joe Girardo. Undergraduate students at Brown University vote in favor of reparations for students who descended from slaves. A report commissioned by Brown University over a decade ago revealed that the school's namesake family was deeply involved in the transatlantic slave trade. Citing the school's history with slavery, the school's undergraduate students have voted in favor of the university providing reparations for descendants of those who were enslaved. According to CNN, in 2003, a report was commissioned by the university's first black president, Ruth J. Simmons, to investigate the Brown family's ties to the slave trade. The report was eventually released in 2006 and found that the Brown family had taken multiple trips to Africa with the sole purpose of acquiring slaves. Undergraduate Council of Students, UCS, President Jason Carroll, whose parents are both descendants of slaves, proposed the vote and also wrote a referendum demanding the university finally take action on the report. Carroll said, "We have a whole new direction as a nation, a whole new understanding of black advocacy. I think before this past summer saying, 'You support Black Lives Matter,' was honestly somewhat controversial. It wasn't until the murder of Mr. George Floyd and the protest last summer that it became something that was mainstream enough that universities like Brown would say it also." Over 2,000 students participated in that vote, with the majority in favor of providing preferential treatment to students whose ancestors were enslaved. Following quote from CNN, "For specific communities found to have direct ties to the slave trade, the vote asked for targeted investment, engagement efforts, recruitment in high schools with large black student populations, and relationships and partnerships with colleges and universities near descendant communities, such as in southern states. A total of 2,024 students voted when the final tally was taken Friday, and over 80% voted in support of reparations for descendants. The university gets to make up its own mind when it comes to the student body. But what's important is getting the word out that this vast majority of students did approve of something. The ball is in the university's court now," said Carroll. "It's really an expression of student sentiment." Carroll, a senior, said the richness of what Brown's history can mean for communities affected by the slave trade and directly tied to the university. The vote on his referendum also called for more identification of those directly affected by the Brown family's actions. "Although we can't all go back and change the past, both private and public institutions in the U.S. have the opportunity and responsibility to reconcile the unaccounted for and unpaid labor that gave them their power by giving back to the communities they have helped marginalize." That is a quote from Lauren Wilson, co-president of Brown's Black Student Union. As Carol mentioned, the students have voiced their opinion on the direction they want the university to take. And now it's on the university to determine how, if at all, it will respond to the student body's vote. Confronting questions of reparations and institutional reckoning with connections to the transatlantic slave trade has a deep history at Brown, said university spokesman Brian Clark. He added, the university interrogated this issue as a full community between 2003 and 2006, and Brown committed to a series of actions whose impact persists in our education, research, engagement with historically underrepresented groups, and ongoing work in diversity, equity, and inclusion. The current work of Brown's Task Force on Anti-Black Racism will make recommendations on more Brown can do to address the legacy of slavery. While it's unclear if the school is going to take action on any of the students' proposals, it's at the very least heartening to see that a large portion of the student body is in favor of trying to rectify the mistakes of the past. The next one's also written by Joe Girotta. 7 Texas cops are fired after black man dies in custody. 7 cops were fired on Thursday after a black man died while being held in a Texas jail. According to the Associated Press, Marvin Scott III, 26, was arrested on March 14th at an Allen, Texas, outlet mall for marijuana possession. Officers initially took Scott to a hospital because they said he was acting erratically. After Scott was eventually released, he was taken to jail, where Collin County Sheriff Jim Skinner said in a news release that his erratic behavior continued. Detention officers responded by restraining him, pepper spraying him, and putting a spit mask on him, because apparently that's what cops define as a reasonable response. At some point during the incident, Scott lost consciousness and was later pronounced dead after he was taken to a hospital. Scott's family has said that Scott was schizophrenic, and it's possible he could have been suffering from a mental health crisis. The family said they have hired a forensic pathologist to provide an independent autopsy to determine Scott's cause of death. If a man suffering from mental illness dying after cops put a spit mask on him sounds familiar, it should, as the circumstances of Scott's death are tragically similar to Daniel Prude's in Rochester, New York last year. In the news release, Skinner revealed that 7 officers had been fired as their actions during the incident violated several of the sheriff's office policies and procedures, while an 8th officer had resigned. The names and races of the officers have not been publicly released, and an investigation into Scott's death is currently being conducted by the Texas Rangers. A statement from the civil rights attorney Lee Merritt, who is representing Scott's family, notes that the officers were fired a day after Scott's funeral. Just one day after the funeral of Marvin Scott III, the Collin County Sheriff has fired 7 detention officers in connection with his death, read the statement. We are pleased with this decision and consider this progress. The statement went on to call for the officers to be arrested and charged with Scott's death. Circling back to the topic of voter suppression and efforts, this one is written by Terrell Germain Starr. It was posted on Friday the 2nd. Michigan Democrats move to block voter suppression efforts by Republicans. Michigan Lieutenant Governor Garland Gilchrist is calling on congressional Democrats to pass federal legislation that will counter GOP efforts at the state level to limit access to the ballot box. Gilchrist is urging members of Congress to pass the H.R. 1 bill, known as the For the People Act, which addresses voting rights, campaign finance, and ethics rules. The roadblock may get stuck in the Senate unless Democrats eliminate the 60-vote filibuster threshold. so that it can pass with a simple majority. Meanwhile, Michigan Republicans have already introduced 39 voting bills that will impose new restrictions. The federal legislation is certainly an important tool in the toolbox because it will, I think, set up protections for voters across the board, said Gilchrist. Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer will most certainly veto any anti-voting bill Republicans send to her desk, but they'll likely try and sidestep her by using a law that allows the legislature to pass measures without the governor's signature by gathering 340,000 signatures. President Joe Biden won the state by a slim margin in 2020. Republicans immediately made false claims that mass election fraud took place. None of those were proven true. Here is more on what Gilchrist is saying about Michigan Republicans' efforts. The quote is from CNN. Gilchrist and other Democrats have characterized Republicans' actions as racist. Experts have said the restrictive voting measures GOP lawmakers are advancing across the nation disproportionately affect minority communities. And Gilchrist said the Republican proposals would be especially punitive in cities like Detroit and Flint, which have large black populations. When we saw the attempt to undermine the integrity of the results in Michigan, we saw very targeted attempts to really question and challenge what happened in the city of Detroit, the biggest city with the most voters in our state, he said. I think it's also clear that, you know, Republicans in Michigan have been working for a long time to try to limit access to voting for black voters in Michigan, many of whom live in the city of Detroit like I do. Republicans responded to Gilchrist's comments by accusing him of, quote, coarsening the debate over voting reform with reckless claims of racism. According to Ted Goodman, communications director for the Michigan Republican Party, an overwhelming majority of Americans and black Americans favor voter ID to ensure the security of our elections. Even the Democratic Party requires IDs to vote in their state party conventions. End of quote from CNN. It is important to note that Detroit, where most black people live in Michigan, and it is the blackest city in America, was the primary target for false Republican voter claims. Also at issue are the two other female Democrats who hold key statewide seats, Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson and Attorney General Dana Nessel, both of whom are up for re-election next year. Michigan Republican Party Chairman Ron Weiser, who is driving the racist voter restrictions to be implemented in time for the 2022 election, said in a speech last week that Whitmer, Benson, and Nessel were, quote, three witches, and said Republicans should make sure they are, quote, ready for burning at the stake. In short, the Republican effort to cheat themselves to victory is gaining traction in the Midwest. And the next one, written by Michael Harriet, Major League Baseball moves 2021 All-Star Game from Atlanta in response to the voter suppression law. Major League Baseball will move its signature mid-season event out of Atlanta because how the hell could they spend a whole weekend talking about All-Star voting in a state that doesn't allow people to vote? MLB's 2021 All-Star Weekend was expected to bring tens of millions of dollars to Georgia's booming wing industry, while probably boosting the take-home pay for gentlemen's club employees in the Atlanta metro area. But those lemon pepper wet dreams are now dashed after the Pro Baseball League called foul on the state's new whites-only voting law. According to ESPN, I have decided that the best way to demonstrate our values as a sport is by relocating this year's All-Star Game and MLB Draft. Major League Baseball fundamentally supports voting rights for all Americans and opposes restrictions to the ballot box, MLB Commissioner Rob Manfred said in a statement, and he went on, We will continue with our plans to celebrate the memory of Hank Aaron during this season's All-Star festivities. In addition, MLB's planned investments to support local communities in Atlanta as part of our All-Star Legacy projects will move forward. We are finalizing a new host city, and details about these events will be announced shortly. And a quote from USA Today reports, on March 26th, Georgia Governor Brian Kemp signed legislation passed by both state houses, a Republican-led overhaul of state elections, rolling back voting by mail and other absentee balloting efforts, and even banning the distribution of food and water to those standing in line to vote. President Joe Biden called the bill sick and un-American, and on March 31st, he told ESPN he would support MLB moving its Midsummer Classic out of Atlanta, just more than 3 months before its stars were to gather July 13th for the 91st All-Star Game. Manfred did just that. While the Atlanta Braves franchise was perfectly fine with black people not being able to drink water while they stood in line to see if white people were going to let them vote, the team said they were deeply disappointed by the MLB's move, noting that businesses, employees, and fans in Georgia are the victims of this decision. If only there was some mechanism to allow these people to voice their concerns. Anyway, plantation overseer Brian Kemp, who also spends time suppressing voters as Georgia's governor, was so upset he damn near lost his will. Oops, pardon me, I have to. He's catching me off guard here. I'm going to start that over. Anyway, plantation overseer Brian Kemp, who also spends time suppressing voters as Georgia's governor, was so upset he damn near lost his will to poop on his black residents. Almost. Today, Major League Baseball caved to fear, political opportunism, and liberal lies, said Kemp, while taking a break from contemplating his next act of racism. He went on, Georgians and all Americans should fully understand that the MLB's knee-jerk decision means cancel culture and woke political activists are coming for every aspect of your life, sports included. If the left doesn't agree with you, facts and the truth do not matter. He goes on, this attack on our state is the direct result of repeated lies from Joe Biden and Stacey Abrams about a bill that expands access to the ballot box and ensures the integrity of our elections. I will not back down. Georgians will not be bullied. We will continue to stand up for secure, accessible, fair elections. Earlier today, I spoke with the leadership of the Atlanta Braves, who informed me they do not support the MLB's decision. Then Kemp looked around, grabbed a baseball bat, smashed his life-size replica of Martin Luther King Jr., and asked his security team if there was a black person around who they could arrest. Thankfully, no one knocked on the door. End of article. I forgot to warn you, this is an opinion piece. And I guess I'll be moving to the entertainment world for the following several articles. I'd like to include that on a general basis. And we have first, written by Jay Connor, Van Lathan wants to know if given the opportunity, would you end racism or take $100 billion instead? This is going to make reference to a podcast. On the latest episode of The Ringer's Higher Learning, which you should absolutely subscribe to, since I would never steer you wrong, co-hosts Van Lathan and The Bachelorette alumna Rachel Lindsay ponder a question that's been tormenting even the deepest recesses of the internet since Tuesday. Lathan begins, the fates come to you. They say, hey, look, you got two choices. We're going to give you $100 billion to go live your life and do whatever you want with it, or we can end racism forever. Would you take the $100 billion or end the racism forever? Lindsay, who was an attorney in a past life and is a bit too hip to the BS to just take the bait, proceeds to seek out clarification. She asks, if I end racism, what does that entail? Does it end racism in the sense that people no longer judge you by the color of your skin? people don't see that? Like everybody's on the same playing field? Nah, Lathan responds. It's not that racism never existed. Lindsay then asks if black folks get reparations, and Lathan explains, nope. The entire exchange is interesting, and one that transformed social media into a battlefield. I spent a good chunk of my Tuesday mulling the answer over myself. Because if you end racism, racial inequality still exists in the form of our disproportionate socioeconomic status and other shortcomings. Since we're still 400 years behind and counting. So, inevitably, while racism would no longer exist, discrimination would remain prevalent because we'd still be drawing from inferior resources. There'd still be haves and have-nots. And, since marginalized groups would continue to be pissed at this disparity, eventually we'd be right back to, wait for it, living in a racist society. But on the flip side, if you take the money and commit to being altruistic instead of buying up every crab leg in the ocean, is $100 billion enough to dismantle systemic roadblocks and erase the racial wealth gap? No. From the Brookings Blueprints for American Renewal and Prosperity Project, centuries of discrimination and exploitation have left black Americans much poorer than white Americans. The median white household has a net worth 10 times that of the black median black household. If black households held a share of the national wealth in proportion to their share of the U.S. population, it would amount to $12.68 trillion in household wealth, which is different from the actual sum of $2.5 trillion. The total racial wealth gap, therefore, is $10.14 trillion. And that's just black folks. Imagine what that number looks like once you factor in every other race that's been on the receiving end of white people's BS. Ain't enough zeros in the galaxy for that check. That's also the fact that by investing $100 billion into the black community in order to make a valiant attempt to correct course, you would inevitably have to align yourself with the likes of Candace Owens or Van Jones under the banner of the greater good. Morally, are you really about that? This leaves a third option, just taking the money and doing you. But if black folks find out you selfishly chose $100 billion over ending racism for everybody else, you really think the black community is going to just let that rock? Good luck with that. As you can imagine, there's been plenty of colorful responses to this question on Twitter. And if you're dying to know what Van and Rachel's final answers were, then do yourself a favor and check out their podcast. I'll repeat the name when I'm finished with the article. But if you're brave enough to answer the question yourself, I'm dying to know, would you end racism or take the $100 billion? And the podcast is called Higher Learning. So, next one is in relationship to a new Netflix series started Friday, called Concrete Cowboy. Black people have been cowboys. Concrete Cowboy cast reflect on the legacy of black cowboys. This is written by Felice Leon. When did you first learn that black cowboys exist? For actor and producer Idris Elba, it was Bob Marley's Buffalo Soldier that made him aware of black cowboys in America. Lorraine Toussaint grew up during the era of Buck and the Preacher, a classic film starring Sidney Poitier and Harry Belafonte, two black men, which was set in the Wild Wild West. But alas, these were fictional characters. And for rapper-turned-actor Cliff Method Man Smith, it was Posse, also a fictional movie, directed and starred by Mario Van Peebles, which opened his eyes to this space where black cowboys reigned supreme. But black cowboys aren't just fabled characters who we occasionally see depicted in media. Black cowboys are real, but this story of black men riding horses, catching outlaws, and victoriously riding into the sunset in the Wild Wild West often isn't told. In fact, the Lone Ranger was based on a black man. His name is B-A-S-S. Bass Reeves, who was born into slavery, escaped, and after emancipation became a lawman and a real-life superhero. The more you know. In North Philly, black cowboys have been a part of the culture for over a century and still exist today. And in fact, they operate the Fletcher Street Stables, which is included in the film, and are the subject of Netflix's Concrete Cowboy. The Ricky Staub-directed film is based on the novel Ghetto Cowboy by G. Neri, and it stars Idris Elba, Caleb McLaughlin, Gerald Jerome, Lorraine Toussaint, Cliff Method Man Smith, and members of the Fletcher Street Stables. And just a second short piece by the same author on the same series, how Idris Elba and Caleb McLaughlin honor black fatherhood in Netflix's Concrete Cowboy. What does it take to be a black dad raising a black child in a world that sees blackness as a threat? While Netflix's Concrete Cowboy explores the little-known story of black cowboys in North Philly who operate the Fletcher Street Stables, parentheses, and still exist today, at the heart of this film is a story of black fatherhood. Oh, pardon me, your reader says, apparently this is not a series but a film. I haven't had a chance to watch it yet, so I wasn't sure about that. We've heard the tale before. 15-year-old Cole, played by Caleb McLaughlin, acts out and is expelled from school and subsequently is sent to live with his distant father, Harp, played by Elba, in Philadelphia. But what is truly captivating about this film and its characters' relationship is the vulnerability that these two bring to their roles. Cole is a hurt black boy who, though he might not admit it, deeply wants to reconcile with his dad. Harp, despite being tough as nails and resolute, is still figuring out fatherhood. The intensity in the relationship between this father and a teenage son is real, but their most important undercurrent is love. The love between this pair is perhaps most powerfully depicted in a scene in a dark room where, after a heated argument, Harp explains the origin of Cole's name. In fact, the movie is so touching that in a previous interview, Elba revealed that he cried after seeing his completed film. As fatherhood is such a prominent theme of the film, and Elba has been quite vocal about the bond he had with his father, who he lost in 2013 to lung cancer, we asked the duo, what is the greatest lesson that you have learned from your father? Oh, pardon me, I don't see the answer anywhere in this little piece, but the Ricky Staub-directed film stars Idris Elba, Caleb McLaughlin, Gerald Jerome, Lorraine Toussaint, Cliff Method Man Smith, and members of the Fletcher Street Stables, and it is available on Netflix beginning Friday, April 2nd. I'm guessing that there's a video to match. Yes, there is. They offer a video to match this little piece, which probably includes that interview that they gave. And if you're going to theroot.com to access that, it's called Honoring Black Fatherhood. And I think I'll close this week's program with a couple of virtual entertainment options. If you're hearing this in time for the April 4th offering, it says here, don't forget to virtually pop out in your Sunday best for this weekend's versus battle between legendary groups Earth, Wind, and Fire and the Isley Brothers. Steve Harvey is hosting, so you know both the jokes and the music are going to be on fire. The Liduation starts at 8 p.m. Eastern Time on the official versus Instagram and Triller page, and that's spelled V-E-R-Z-U-Z. for the Battle of the Bands. And April 8th, looks like, is the other one. Toronto R&B pop singer Ali Gatti will be putting on an exclusive live-streamed performance taking place for 2 days, the 8th and 9th, in partnership with premium digital live platform Moment House. And it looks like you need tickets for that. Might turn out to be free tickets. Nope, that'll cost you a minimum of just under $16 and can be accessed at www.momenthouse.com, all one word, M-O-M-E-N-T, like this moment, momenthouse.com. And the other one for the 8th, 92Y presents Criminal Injustice, Accountability and Reform, an intimate conversation about the oft-hidden cruelty and violence happening every day in courtrooms across the country. You will listen along as the speakers discuss the intersection of arts and criminal justice, how we need to fight for its survival, justice, as it is under attack. The event starts at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. It is free, but you need to register, which you can do by going to 92Y's website, which is www.92.org. That one's entitled Criminal Justice, Accountability, and Reform for Thursday, April 8th, 6 p.m. Eastern Time. That brings me to the end of our time. Thank you for joining us. This is the Black Experience Hour, and you're listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. Please tune into all of our programs.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.